CIA committee responsible for the composition of the design standards governing antenna and antenna tower design. That's a mouthful. And fabrication, and was the primary author of the electrical grounding section of this standard. David Davies. Thank you.
I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with ERI. We make several different products, high-power TV antennas, also FM antennas, mobile media antennas. We produce rigid line, transmission line, and we also make towers. ERI made its first tower in 1943, and we went on about a 50-something year hiatus because we realized there was actually no money in making towers. For some reason, about 1990 or so, we decided to try it again, and we discovered once again there's still not much money in making towers. But nevertheless, we proceeded forward. Now, when I go out with salesmen, I hear this question a lot. Why in the world would you want to buy a tower from an antenna manufacturer? And you know, that's a great question, and I'll get back to that a little later. What we're going to talk about today is how the tower movement affects the antenna. And actually, it affects it by the stresses it puts on the antenna, and by the way, it changes the characteristics, the broadcast characteristics of the antenna. We all think of towers as being rather rigid and stable creatures, and the antennas that they support are rigid and stable. But they're actually quite dynamic. They tend to move quite a lot. And we're going to talk about these different types of movement and how they affect the antenna. They affect the antenna, obviously, from a mechanical standpoint. They can cause premature failure, electrical components, break bolts, break brackets. But what's unseen and unknown about a lot of this is how they affect the electrical characteristics of the antenna in terms of coverage degradation and diminished antenna gain. There's two types of movement that we're going to discuss, and the code breaks it down into two types of movement: movement in the horizontal plane and the vertical plane, where movement in the horizontal plane is a twist. Movement in the vertical plane is actually divided into two different sections. And this is right out of the current standard. You say, wait a minute, you said there are two types of movement. I see three things up there. Well, twist is movement in the horizontal plane, or the main beam of the antenna moving in a horizontal plane. Displacement and sway are actually the same thing. It's just that sway is the instantaneous displacement. If I could take that a little further back to this picture, if you see, obviously, the twist, rotation in the horizontal plane, this is from the non-wind load position of the tower. Displacement would be how much the tower moved horizontally from the non-movement position, where joint rotation is what happens at one critical aspect of that movement. Or to explain it another way, here's displacement. The green line is displacement. But if you look at a line that is tangent to the curve at the tower at any one place on the tower, you would get joint rotation. Well, as you can see on the top plate of this tower, the joint rotation angle is much steeper than the displacement angle. So I'm going to be using these terms in and out. I just want you to understand the difference between them. So we would think that the design code would protect us from excessive movement because, you know, as much as we all love towers, or maybe I may be the only guy in this room that loves towers. To the rest of you, they're just necessary evils to support your antenna. But you would think the standard that dictates how these towers are designed would give you suitable antenna performance. The F code, and actually the codes that preceded that all the way to the C code, had an antenna operational requirement, and that was it would not allow an overall a signal degradation to exceed 10 dB. So did you know, all you guys that have F code towers, that if it strictly adheres to the F code and there's nothing additional in it, your antenna is allowed to have signal degradation of up to 10 dB, or 1/10 power, during a service wind condition. This isn't the maximum load. This is a service wind condition, 50 miles per hour, something it could experience several times a year. The F code had no serviceability requirements in terms of displacement or sway. Now it came out with a G-code, bigger and better, right? The G-code did away with the antenna operational requirements. It did insert serviceability requirements. Those requirements are the displacement is no greater than 5% of the structural height, meaning the horizontal movement could not exceed 5% of the height of the tower. Well, if you think about that, that's basically a tangent. So you take the inverse tangent of that, and it translates to 2.9 degrees displacement. Rotation or sway in either plane, horizontal or vertical, can exceed 4 degrees. And for tubular antennas, top mount tubular antennas, the displacement can't be greater than 1% of the height, which is 6/10 of a degree. So, G-code's better. Well, maybe. Let's see. You get 2.9 degrees tower displacement, 4 degrees tower sway, and 6/10 of a degree in top mount antenna displacement for a worst-case scenario of 4.6 degrees. Now, we can't count both displacement and tower sway. Remember, sway is the first derivative of displacement. So worst case is we're just taking the displacement at the top plate and the displacement of the antenna. Now, how does that relate to antenna performance, now that I've taken you through all this pseudo-math? Well, we're going to primarily be talking about, at this point, vertical plane plots, or if you would take the antenna radiation pattern and slice it top to bottom and look at it. Bob Sret yesterday was talking about a donut. Exactly right, it's a donut without a hole in it. So it's a three-dimensional circle around the tower. The more gain the antenna, the flatter the lobe, the primary lobe. Now, this is a little exaggerated, but we're not reaching many of our viewers this way. So most TV antennas and some FM antennas put beam tilt into the antenna. I think we were talking about this last night. Electrical beam tilt. And the area that we're going to be concerned with is this area right here, which is at the horizon, which is where the signal-to-noise ratio is very crucial. And as this, I described it last night, as a very shallow dish. Think of an inverted, very shallow dish. As the tower moves, you're inducing mechanical beam tilt in this dish. So the horizon, where it strikes the horizon, will move up and down this edge of the curve. So here is the same information, this vertical plane plot. The antenna would be here. Actually, this has 3/4 of a degree beam tilt, so the antenna would be here. This would be looking towards the horizon, and this is the energy distribution on this side below the antenna and on this side above the antenna. This is a relative field, so if we compare relative field values to dB loss, this is how the relative field is explained, with this being 100% of field or no loss, 90% of field, 1 dB down, or 1/10, or I'm sorry, what is 1 dB, guys? 10% loss, 3 dB, 70% of field, half power, 10 dB, 1/10 power. So if we compare 3.7 to 0.7 here, at this point on the curve, we're 3 dB down. So let's go back to the G-code, which it allowed 4.6 degrees deflection. If we come out 4.6 degrees depressed angle and come over to the relative field, we're 16.5 dB down. So a G-code tower without any stipulations other than meet the G-code will give you an antenna performance during service wind conditions, 50 mile per hour service wind conditions, that will allow up to 16.5 dB loss in your signal strength. So maybe it's not better than the F-code. You know, it kind of went the other way on us. Now, this is worst case. I mean, this is meeting the minimum requirements of the F-code. Let's look at some reasonably designed towers. And we're going to look at three different towers, a 460-foot tower, a 1,000-foot tower, and a 1,500-foot tower. We're going to look at these by both the FNG code, 70 mile per hour design wind speed for the F-code, 90 mile per hour for the G-code, and that equates to a service wind speed of 50 miles per hour for the F-code and 60 mile per hour for the G-code. At this point, we're just looking at TV antennas. For all you FM guys, stand by. We're going to look at FM antennas too. Modest loading on the tower. This is a printout of the ERI tower design program. ERI developed this several years ago. We've since sold it to RISA. It's available to anyone who wants to buy a tower analysis and design program. It is the majority of the tower consulting engineers and manufacturers use this program. I explain this to you because there are some features in this program that I'm going to want to have you look at a little later. Part of this program gives the deflection, tilt, and twist in a graphical readout. It also gives it in a data readout. But you can see on these two towers, we're looking at a deflection. This is the 1,000-foot tower. We're looking at a deflection of like 5.5 feet, tilt or sway at the top plate of 1.6 degrees and a twist of around 4 degrees. Okay, so we're going to run through these three towers. Here's the 460-foot self-supporting tower. We have a joint rotation at the top plate of 1.6 degrees. We have antenna sway of 5 degrees, so the total displacement angle of that is 2.1 degrees. For the side mount antenna, rather than looking at the joint rotation, we're just going to look at the displacement. That's a little more conservative, as I showed you earlier, and it's also applicable to most FM antennas. So we're just looking at the displacement, the change in the horizontal value over the height value, inverse tangent, 1.4 degrees. Now, all of these towers, both the 1,000-foot tower and the 1,600-foot tower, came out with almost exactly the same displacement values. So here's a summary. 460-foot self-supporting tower. All these towers ended up for the top mount antenna of about 2.1 degrees. With the antenna used, 28-bay UHF TV antenna, that equated to a 10 dB signal degradation during a service wind condition. For the side mount antenna, it equated to a 7 dB degradation at service wind condition. How did we get there? Okay, there's the 2.2 degrees coming down the slope of the vertical plane pattern. On the underside, there's the 10 dB down. But remember, every time it tips this way, the other side tips up, right? So let's look at the other side. Again, 2.2 degrees, we're down at 19.2 dB. So the top mount antenna during service wind conditions would vary in between 10 dB loss, which is 1/10th power, and 20 dB loss, which is 1/100th power. The side mount antenna varies between 7 dB and 12 dB. What's this mean to your coverage, to your audience? Well, in the era where most American males tend to go into a fetal position if they don't have a remote control in their hand, and you get a 10 to 20 dB loss, in effect, what you're doing is bringing the cliff much closer to your center of radiation. You're eroding your coverage area. How long does it take? Once you lose signal lock, you know, the receiver can stop analyzing that signal, what's it take? 1.5 to 3 seconds to regenerate that signal. But if the tower's continually moving, this could go on for 15, 20, 25 seconds. What happens when we got a remote control in our hand and we see that blue screen? Well, we all know what happens. Okay. So how about FM antennas? We're going to talk about mechanical beam tilt here, but there's something else that goes on with an FM antenna. With a TV antenna, the aperture or the radiating slots are very close to the center line of the structure. But with an FM antenna, the radiators are offset. So as this structure bends either one way or the other, the aperture of the antenna either shrinks or expands. So as we do that, we also get diminished antenna gain from the shift in the aperture, and we get some electrical beam tilt and null fill from the shift of the aperture. So we're going to look at an 8-bay antenna. Again, ERI tower design program, a pretty standard pole, 8-bay antenna, we looked at a base elevation of 500 feet meaning the base of the antenna is at 500 feet in the air, 60 mile per hour service wind speed, which equates to 50 mile per hour in the F code. This is the data printout that our program presents, and it gives you the horizontal deflection, and you can see at the top of the pole, 500 foot base, 80 foot pole, top of the pole, 28 inches deflection. And this is the same curve I showed you earlier for the TV towers. Here's the deflection curve, there's the tilt curve. So we take 28 inches deflection, divide it by the aperture of the antenna, 70 feet, 80-foot pole, 10, I just figured 10 feet in between each element. Take the inverse tangent of that, and we got 1.9 degrees mechanical tilt. Now, this is just the deflection angle. It's not the sway angle. And we're just going to look at deflection, the more conservative of the two values. So if we add that deflection to the deflection that we saw, not the sway, but the deflection we saw in those three towers, we have between 1.4 and 1.5 degrees deflection in the three towers that we looked at earlier, plus the deflection of the antenna ray gave us a deflection of 3.3 to 3.4 degrees. So here's our 8-bay plot that Bob showed you yesterday. It's 8-bay antenna, minor loads. If we go out to the amount of degrees that we deflected, 4.75 degrees, and go to where the field strength is, we're at 0.65% of field strength, or 3.75 dB down. That's just one of three losses we're going to see in the FM antenna. Again, as this pole bends, actually the vertical distance between the elements, we just showed the top and bottom element, but the vertical elements decrease. To calculate that amount of deduction, I won't take you through all the math, but it came out to 22.2 inches. So here I took 840 inches minus 22.2 divided by 840. That's 0.75 or 0.97 lambda. So lambda has decreased by 3 degrees, or it's increased by 3 degrees. Here's the gain of that 8-bay antenna in a non-load condition, non-wind load condition. But because the aperture has shrunk, now the gain at 0.75 lambda is down to 6.4, and of the expanded aperture, it's 6.4. So we lost somewhere in between 0.1 dB and 0.05 dB just from the antenna array flexing. We also have electrical beam tilt to put in here, and we talked about beam tilt last night. And null fill. The way I like to describe null fill is it's as if all of a sudden you put on a bad set of glasses. You know, because some of the elements get out of it. You ever looked at, tried to read the newspaper with bifocals and get it a little bit out of your bifocal, and you know how the print kind of smudges? Well, that same thing happens with null fill. We kind of smudge that pattern to fill the nulls in the antenna. Well, and we do that by changing the phase of part of the array. As we shrink the array, we're changing its phase. We're altering its phase, so we get some null fill and some beam tilt. Again, here's the gain of the 8-bay antenna in the non-wind condition. Here's the gain of the antenna shrunk and the gain of the antenna expanded. So if we put all these together, the three different losses, we come up with 4.75 dB loss. And what that means to that 8-bay antenna is the power gain, not the dB, but the power gain went from 4.48 dB down to 1.5 dB. Again, this is during a 50-mile-an-hour service wind condition. Now, I have copies of these charts if anybody wants them later, but this is just a general guide to let you understand how the number of elements in the array compares to the amount of movement that you allow within the tower. And don't think of this as gain, just think of it as the number of elements. Doesn't matter if it's circularly polarized, single polarization, dual polarization, whatever. Number of elements. So with a 4-bay antenna, whether it's a TV antenna or an FM antenna, you get to the half beam width, 3 dB down, at 6.65 degrees of movement. Obviously, the higher you get, the number, the higher the gain, the higher the number of elements, the less movement it takes to get to that 3 dB mark, because the primary beam is so much narrower. And the same for the 10 dB mark, and the amplitude, or the differential amplitude, is how many dB you lose per degree of movement in the steepest angle of the vertical plane plot. I've got another way to describe that. And I've got copies of this, too, if anybody's interested in it. Again, think of this as the number of elements in your array, and this is the sway, or how much the tower is moving. So if we come out to an 8-bay antenna, which would be right about here, and go up to about 4-something degrees, and this is just from the mechanical, not including what's happening to the elements, and this line is 6 dB loss. So you're about, 5 dB down or something like that. Okay, just a rough check for you if you want to see what's going on, if you know the data on your antenna. Now, what else happens to the antenna? Well, you have mechanical stress due to this tower movement. And actually, this array shifting downwards is going to compress that interbay line. And the compression in this account, and this is a pretty radical, I mean, this meets the EIA standard. And something else I need to explain is this term right here, which is called the radius of curvature, which is another way of explaining tower flexibility, especially antenna mount flexibility. The radius of curvature would be the length of that line to meet this curve. So if the curve is steeper, the radius would be shorter. If the curve is not as severe, the radius would be longer. Okay. But this meets the G code, but in doing so, because we're curving and compressing that interbay line, we're putting approximately 4,000 psi axial load on the interbay line and about 8,000 psi bending moment on that. If you combine those two, it's approximately 15,000 psi maximum extreme fiber stress. Well, the minimum yield strength of brass is 12,000 psi. So maybe that antenna is not going to fail the first time it happens, because you're going to get certain deformation. You're going to get certain plastic action. But as that antenna continually moves back and forth on that flexible of a tower, eventually you're going to fail the interbay line. Okay, let's talk about movement in the horizontal plane now, or twist. And we talked about this last night for directional patterns. You know, how much twist is acceptable, and they're wanting to take it to the 100th place in the surveyor. Well, the code just says 4 degrees. You can do up to 4 degrees twist. Where that becomes critical for an antenna is when you have these high roll-off areas or these very sharp roll-off areas. You can get quite a bit of change in relative field just by tolerating that much twist. And some patterns get pretty tight, so the roll-offs get pretty tight, directional TV patterns. So basically, you can expect, with 5 degrees twist, you could expect 4 dB loss in a slot antenna and up to 20 dB loss in some panel antennas. Okay, we're going to talk horizontal plane patterns some more, but this is how does the tower actually affect the horizontal plane pattern. I'm not talking about movement anymore. I'm talking about how does that steel that acts like a parasite in the aperture of the antenna affect the horizontal plane pattern of the antenna. What we're showing here, this is a low-power TV antenna. It's an omnioid pattern. It's an ALP antenna. This is the free space pattern, meaning what the pattern should look like if the antenna was magically suspended without any support. The next pattern is a measured pattern showing what this same antenna would look like if it's mounted on a tower structure. You can see you're experiencing quite a bit of loss, as you would expect, behind the antenna, about 3 dB loss behind the antenna, just from the support structure. In FM antennas, there's yet another problem. Because most tower sections are made in 20-foot lengths, and there's only one FM frequency that's evenly divisible into a 20-foot length, that means in a multiple-bay array, elements hit different geometric locations on the tower section. So each element seen a different electrical backdrop. Well, this has the effect of reducing the value of pattern studies, because the only difference between this is the same antenna, the same tower, the same day, same everything. The only difference between this pattern and this pattern is that this antenna is mounted at the left-hand intersection of the diagonal, and that pattern's at the right-hand intersection of the diagonal. The only difference here is this antenna is mounted in between the girts, this one's mounted at the girt. So if let's say you're selecting your pattern study and you're trying to optimize your antenna. Now this isn't parasites, nothing else. This is just steel behind the antenna. And you had something like an interstate or something that ran right here, and you wanted to make sure to maximize your coverage in this area, so you selected this pattern, but you end up with that pattern, which is about a 6 dB difference. All of a sudden you're going to say, hey, Mr. Installer, you installed my antenna wrong. Or, hey, manufacturer, your antenna is not working right. Well, the antenna is working fine. It's just throwing a pattern somewhere. The aggregate pattern of all those bays is somewhere in between these two patterns. Where is that extra? Where is it? What happened to this energy? Where did it go? Well, some of it went in the primary lobe, just in a different direction. But most of it goes into the side lobes. You know, goes into all those little squiggly lines underneath the primary lobe. That's why sometimes when you pick an antenna, because it puts a null in the vertical plane pattern at a certain spot that you want to protect, and all of a sudden you're getting the interference there, you're getting a hot spot, and you can't figure out why, it's because of the tower distortion. The tower is not only distorting the horizontal plane pattern, it's distorting the vertical plane pattern also. It's putting some null fill in there for you, even though you didn't want it. So, why buy a tower from an antenna manufacturer? Okay, I'm going to go through some solutions here, and you're going to have to suffer through a short commercial break. Like so many things in life, let me view around here, stiffer is better, guys. Okay, the stiffer you can make the tower, the better it's going to be for antenna performance. Unfortunately, it's also more expensive. But to go from a 3-degree tower to a 1.5-degree tower is about 10 to 12%, maybe less, depending upon the design and the antenna requirements. Okay. ERI developed this lambda antenna mounting section. I think you heard Bob refer to it last night. For a couple different reasons. One was the stiffness, to increase the stiffness or decrease the displacement of the tower. The second is to reduce the impact that the tower has on the horizontal plane pattern. Lambdas typically have a radius of curvature around 1,600 feet. Most of the stuff we look at has a radius of curvature around 800 feet, and as I explained, that pole that we looked at had a radius of curvature of 500 feet. All still meet the EIA requirements. It's just stiffer. Because the lambda is made in even separations, or the distance between the antenna is also the distance in between each section, each antenna element mounts at a geometrically identical location on the tower, which means each element throws exactly the same pattern. So you don't have the degradation between pattern A and pattern C. Okay, and in this case, you're experiencing about a 3.5 dB pattern gain for the entire array. No parasites, no funny brackets, just a tower section up there. Also, it can be mounted, there's more than one optimal mounting position. It can be on the top mount or it can be lower in the tower. Lambda is also applicable to TV antennas. Stiffer is better. But look what it does to the radiation pattern of a directional antenna. Here's the omnioid. The dashed line is the free space pattern. The shaded line is the actual measured pattern. Again, dashed line, free space, actual measured pattern. So the lambda can be very reactive to the antenna, or it can be very non-reactive to the antenna. So I'm just about through. In accepting a structural design, that meets the minimum requirements of the EIA, you're basically accepting with a G code up to 10 dB signal strength degradation. Or with a G code, as we showed, it can be even less. It can also lead to structural failure of the antenna. How do you avoid this problem? Well, the first is provide the tower manufacturer criteria that exceeds the minimum requirements of the code. Keep in mind that these design codes establish the minimum requirements, not the optimum, the minimum requirements. So exceed the minimum requirements. Equip yourself with data to tell, if you're commissioning a new tower, to tell the tower manufacturer how much displacement, how much joint rotation, how much horizontal plane rotation your antenna that you're intending to buy will permit. That's when we come back to the charts that I showed you earlier, that you can look at how much signal degradation you get with the number of elements that you're intending to purchase. Or if you have an existing tower and you're thinking about buying a new antenna, you might want to size your antenna based upon the deflection or tower movement that the existing tower is going to provide you. Insist on seeing the design. This is why I told you about the tower design program. The other major program is a program called Tower Mast that's developed by Simon Wiseman. Excellent engineers and excellent design program. Both programs provide you graphical readouts and digital readouts detailing how much deflection, how much tilt, and how much twist you get as a function of the height of the tower. If you're purchasing a new tower, ask the salesman for this data. If he looks at you like, you know, a deer in the headlights, that just means he doesn't understand the purpose you have for your tower. Okay? But they all have the data, and it should be available to you. Equipped with that data, ask the antenna manufacturer for the vertical plane plots and the horizontal plane plots, so that you can see how the tower that you're commissioning is going to act with the antenna that you're also going to purchase or put on it. So, why buy a tower or a tower from an antenna manufacturer? If we haven't covered all that, it's because it's all about antenna performance. So, consider your manufacturer when it's time to commission a new tower. That's all I have, guys. Questions? Yes, sir. Got almost pointing at you. That would have been deadly.
When you do a study on a tower, a wind load study, do you get that information in the results?
Yes. There's no difference between doing a structural analysis of an existing tower and designing a new tower. Program doesn't know the difference. It spits out data to you, and you should insist on viewing that data.
Okay. My other question is, does your software predict if an existing tower will have a low-frequency oscillation problem and then base recommendations on what to do to solve those issues?
Okay. And what he's talking about is guy-wire galloping primarily, low-frequency oscillation. It does not predict that. I'm not aware of a program that will predict that. The rule of thumb, okay, is if your tower is over 1,200 feet, that you should consider including low-frequency dampeners in the initial design, primarily on the upper guy wires. You should also consider high-frequency dampeners. Low-frequency vibration in the guy wire is caused when you have a laminar wind speed, typically 30 to 35 miles per hour, that crosses the guy wire in a horizontal direction. And it's especially escalated if you have some ice, because as the ice forms on the guy wire, it makes like an airfoil. And as the wind passes, it picks the guy wire up until tension gets too big, and then it drops it down. And then it picks it up again. And it's like tying the skip rope on the doorknob and, you know, doing this for a while. It increases in magnitude. It's hard to predict. It's fairly easy to remedy if you witness it. High-frequency vibration is almost the same phenomena, only it's the type of stuff that vibrates bolts or vibrates nuts off bolts. And that's, again, easy to fix. If you're experiencing it, it's a post-construction remedy rather than going to the expense of installing that on all new tires. On top of the John Hancock building, right before the union threatened to throw me off.
Two questions.
If you had a, you know, remember the physics problem? It's all about horizontal velocity, how far before the cannonball hits. If you had enough horizontal velocity, you could probably make it to the lake. Okay.
Two questions. One, the lambda section then is designed to be frequency / wavelength dependent?
Yes.
Okay. Number two, you were looking at compression on that FM antenna example.
Yes.
How much deflection in the other direction is there, and how much loss of contact do you have on the inner vein?
Yeah.
Assuming that they're all moving at the assuming that it's not one joint.
I probably should have taken you through that. I had the different triangles that showed. I think over the length of that array, we had about 5.5 inches of vertical movement, one way or the other. Okay? So if you divide that by the number of bullets in that array, you can see that you're going to get, oh, maybe 0.5 inch or so of movement on each bullet. Not a good thing. Yes, sir.
What's the mathematical relationship between tower sway and wind speed?
The higher the wind speed, the more it'll sway.
Okay, I'll rephrase that. Okay. Is it a linear relationship or something other than that?
I don't know if I have a good answer. I would suspect it is not linear.
That's my suspicion.
The reason I say that is the force, the equation for force is the square of velocity.
You answered my question.
Okay.
Last question.
What do you do about a lambda section when you have diplex antennas under a diplex antenna system with two different frequencies?
The same thing you do for the antenna. Anytime you diplex an antenna, you find a medium frequency or a medium lambda that will work. Assuming that may be too glib of an answer. If you're assuming each partner in the diplexed antenna has equal share, equal stake, then you find a medium frequency, so that the VSWR for each is approximately equal. If one has a much higher share in it, then you tend to slide it towards that higher share. But the spacing between the individual elements, whatever is determined by the antenna engineer, is then matched in the spacing of the lambda section. Okay. And by the way, there's more to the lambda than just the vertical spacing. You also have to look at, you know, how can you get one lambda section that gives you no interaction or very little interaction with the antenna, and another that gives you quite a lot of interaction. It has to do with the length of the members in between the legs and how close to a certain spacing that is, so you tend to vary the angle of the inner members so that you can get the right length, too.
Okay, thank you, Dave.
You're welcome.